I want to start by thanking the comrades of Socialist Alternative for bringing me out to this little corner of the planet. It's unlikely I would have ever made it out here. But I thank you very much for your generosity. It's come to my attention over the last week since I've been traveling around that we are, in fact, two people separated by a common language. So if I say something that sounds particularly stupid or incomprehensible, just, you know, it must be the dialect. But in particular, just so you know, when Americans use the word liberal, they mean exactly the opposite from what it is that you mean. We mean basically mushy sort of left-wingers who don't necessarily have an analysis about how to change things but really fucking hate the way things are. On the other hand, if we say something like craven right-wing maniac, we do mean Bush. So that's the end of the language notes. On a more serious level, the headlines today, I noticed in the mainstream papers in the United States, are filled with the latest announcement about the $1.1 billion that the federal government is to allocate for reconstruction of the city of New Orleans. By my estimation, that's approximately 5 days' worth of funding for the Iraq War. And if you want to understand what underpins the disgust, the anger, the sea change that took place in American politics a few months ago in terms of pushing out the far right, now we have the middling right, we'll get to that in a moment, into leading up our legislative body, leading up the Congress, it really is that economic and social reality, the lingering outrage, 19 and a half months since the Gulf states were devastated. Most of, by the way, the black population of New Orleans is still not back in Biloxi or New Orleans and never will come back at this rate if there is no plan, actually, to rebuild those quarters of the southern states. They'll simply be displaced permanently, and they'll turn New Orleans into essentially a kind of a Disneyland of the French Quarter and homes for the wealthy. Really, that is part of what that and the war and so much else that I'll try and touch on, but hardly be able to really discuss comprehensively tonight. You buy me a beer afterwards, you can hear me rattle on more. You buy me a gin, you'll hear me rattle on a lot worse. But Bush's popularity rating right now in the United States is, he is down to sort of six fools and a dog that support his plan. He's got a support level that is matches pretty much where Richard Nixon was at right at the time when he was forced to resign in 1974 as a result of the Watergate scandal, something, I don't know, just over 20-something percent, 20%, I believe, is where he's at. And there really has been a massive defection, even from the ranks of the Republican Party. The support for the right-wing party in the United States is now down to somewhere around 35%. Increasing numbers of people considering themselves independents, and then just a shy majority for the Democrats. There's even been a massive defection of funding from Wall Street, hardly a bastion of radicalism, but essentially that's their vote on Bush having broken their army and threatened, from their perspective, their empire, Iraq having been really the largest imperial boondoggle in the history of U.S. boondoggles, which have been going on roughly since 1898, when the U.S. first began its imperial drive. And even, you know, leaving the situation of that war in which the enemies of the U.S. Ruling class, the Iranians, appear at this point to be the greatest beneficiaries of that war, which is probably what's fueling the saber-rattling against the Iranian regime right now by the Bush administration. Of course, the economy, increasingly first and foremost on the minds of certainly ordinary Americans, the overwhelming majority of whom have borne the brunt of this $1.7 billion a week war and is now heading into recession. You have a housing boom that fueled the expansion of the economy over the last years, has now come to an end. There are expected to be at least 2.2 million foreclosures on people's homes in this year alone, and personal savings are now at the same rates that they were in the 1920s. That is to say, they're negative. There is a $2 trillion personal debt. It doesn't even begin to touch on what the systems debt is, which they don't really count anymore, or at least they don't publish those numbers. And there is a potential banking crisis that is looming in the wings that I'm sure they'll somehow manage to put off until after the 2008 elections, but I presume that will come crashing down as well. And people may be aware of the old expression, if you owe the bank $10,000, you've got a problem, but when you owe the bank $10 billion, they've got a problem. That is what is beginning to steamroll into an increasing crisis in the United States. But of course, there has been resistance, and that's what some of what we want to talk about tonight, or at least what I want to talk about tonight. And the first of that, and I think it's for us as socialists, as people who believe in the power of the working class, the centrality of the people who produce the wealth in society to control that wealth and to control society. The resistance inside of the armed forces, the very fodder that the empire looks to carry out its adventures, is beginning to rebel. And the rise of the anti-war soldier, of course, is quite important because the armed forces in the United States, like most of the world over, is the working class in uniform. And when the working class in uniform begins to rebel, then the folks at the top of the system truly do have a problem. Just to give some sort of feel for people, I'm sure I don't have to, you know, give you an idea of the horrors of the war itself. Certainly the worst horrors are being experienced by the Iraqi people themselves. I believe the figures this week have now hit 1 million Iraqis dead in this war. You add that body count up to the million prior in the previous decade. That was Clinton's killing fields as a result of the sanctions. And you've got an absolute thoroughgoing devastation, of course, the infrastructure of that society devastated. And then, of course, there was the war that dare not speak its name in Afghanistan, that basically a country that was left in rubble at the beginning of the war has now, they're just continuing to bomb rubble. And I can't even imagine what life must be like in Afghanistan today. But what is fueling some of the outrage inside of the armed forces is that in the previous 5 months you had the highest death toll since the war. And, of course, the war, as people all remember, was famously declared to be over and won not a month or 6 weeks after it began. And, of course, the occupation has been tremendously deadly. In addition to the 3,200-plus American soldiers who were dead, you can add to that body count at least 800 more civilian workers who, it's just been exposed this week, by the way, you know, that hundreds of these thousands of people who were there to do reconstruction have been killed as well. You add to that the fact that you have basically an armed forces, 1.4 million of them have rotated into Afghanistan and Iraq in total. At least a third of those numbers have gone back 3 and 4 times. Unlike the Vietnam War, where there was a draft and there were millions of people that circulated, that, you know, went through Vietnam and Southeast Asia, Cambodia and Laos in that war. You have the same exact people in what is referred to as a volunteer army, but of course what you have in the United States, if not an official draft, you have effectively an economic draft at play. The working class is bearing the brunt of that war. And in fact, unlike Vietnam, in fact, you have more white soldiers from rural and small towns who are dying in that war, as opposed to Vietnam, in which the overwhelming sort of disproportionate numbers were black and brown. So this is something that is getting quite a bit of attention. And at this point, only 23% of the soldiers support being there. You've definitely got a problem when not even a quarter of the soldiers who are fighting that war believe they ought to be there. And 20,000 of them have gone AWOL, that is, absent without leave. They've simply deserted and refused to be deployed. They mostly just disappear. They no longer can do what happened in Vietnam and go up north of the border to Canada. That's largely not an option for people. They just simply try and disappear into society, which is rather difficult, as you can imagine, in modern society where your numbers and your tracking, you literally have very few options of what you can do with your life. We're certainly not at the point where things were at in Vietnam. In the early 70s, you had open rebellion and killing of officers and all the rest of that. That is not what is happening. What we do have is the beginnings of organized opposition. Even the first cafes have been begun outside of the bases. The one in upstate New York, which has the largest number of soldiers serving in Iraq, is called Fort Drum. Right outside of Fort Drum, there's now a cafe called A Different Drummer. And it's anti-war soldiers who actually read, I'm very proud to say this, the International Socialist Organization of the United States, the group that I'm a member of, has a publishing outfit, Haymarket Books. We published a book about the soldiers in revolt in Vietnam. It was reading that book that soldiers got the inspiration to open up that coffee house, and it is now sort of a widely read and distributed book among soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and throughout the bases of the United States. Small organizations can often have disproportionate impact to their size. However, the critical factor, of course, that determines whether disaffection turns to refusal and then resistance has always been organization, and that is still at very embryonic levels in the United States. It's important not to overplay these steps. We're at the very beginning stages of what is a very important struggle taking place, but nonetheless, a very, very important first steps have been taken. And to hear the soldiers speak out, we were just watching a film, Sandra and I, last night, The Ground Truth. It was actually filmed a couple of years ago. I know a number of these fellows because actually the head of the Iraq Veterans Against the War is a woman. Kelly Dougherty was elected the executive director of that movement. That was filmed about a year and a half ago, in which they're basically talking about the horrors that turned them against the war. Now when you hear them speak, they talk about, and actually they have demands, calling for full reparations to the Iraqi people. They defend the right of the Iraqis to resist, a position that wouldn't be bad for more of the left to take in the United States, and actually are quite militant around the demand for not just troops out, but troops out now. The Congress, of course, has begun to have to reflect some of this debate in society that is, and the battle going on in the United States. We'll talk about the protests in a moment. But there's also, of course, as I mentioned before, a shakeup at the top of society that is fueling us as well. As I mentioned, Wall Street beginning to send its funding to, you know, the other war party, the Democrats now, which are now wrangling over something they refer to as the Iraq Accountability Act. See, the line of the Democrats, just so you know, is not exactly an anti-war position. It's sort of like they actually get up there and say, and I think I'm quoting Barack Obama here. He's the senator from the state I'm living in. I live in Chicago, which is in the state of Illinois. He says, we can't keep babysitting the Iraqis. They have to take responsibility for themselves. And absolutely patronizing and disgusting commentary about where the consciousness of the leadership of the Democratic Party is at. But nonetheless, they have had to debate getting out of there. And so this week, the different houses of Congress are now approving basically a very curious bill. It's for both planning some sort of timetable for withdrawal somewhere down the road, 18 months, a year, maybe two, while they approve $124 billion to continue the war. I refer to that as the sort of war now, peace later position. There was a very famous and popular left-wing historian in the United States by the name of Howard Zinn. He's a wonderful human being and a wonderful historian. He describes it this way, and I think he puts what's happening at the top quite well. He says, it's as if before the Civil War, abolitionists agreed to postpone the emancipation of the slaves for a year or 2 years or 5 years, and coupled this with the appropriation of funds to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. Which basically guaranteed the return of slaves to the Confederate South. And he goes on to say, would you give a thug who invaded your house, smashed everything in sight, and terrorized your children a timetable for withdrawal? And that, I think, is very much what we on the left have to understand, these sort of various middling plans of we want to get out, but, you know, somewhere down the road. I want to also talk about I should say something about the mass protests that have happened quite recently. I understand they make the news. There have been protests, of course, in the hundreds of thousands. I think since the elections and all, there's been a bit of a fuel around this. Of course, people went to the polls voting to end the war, and Bush, you know, a man who quite literally can't find his ass with both hands, then comes out and makes a speech saying, "I've heard what you've said, now we're sending 21,000 more troops," which was read by the population as a giant fuck you. And so hundreds of thousands of people hit the streets of Washington, D.C. In late January, and that's great, but these protests have been largely quite episodic. There's another front of the struggle, and one that is worth mentioning here is the massive immigrant rights struggle that exploded onto the scene a year ago. I won't get into it in too much detail. I went around talking about it on campuses earlier in the week. But millions of people took to the streets in response to an attempt to render felons all 12 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, and promptly got that plan off the table. If anybody questions the power of protest, take a look at the speed with which, you know, absolutely draconian legislation can be wiped into the abyss, basically from early March to May Day, which for the first time in decades in the United States was celebrated with mass strikes. That legislation was gone when millions took to the streets. And this is in the consciousness below in the United States. You would never know it. You would never know it by reading the mainstream media. Thank you for Rupert Murdoch, one of the Australian gifts to the United States. But we have our own. We have many of our own. But you would never know it from the mainstream media in the United States, but well over 60% of the American population supports legalization for immigrants. The American Federation of Labor, the AFL-CIO, the main labor federation in the United States, is for legalization for immigrants and against and opposes any kind of scheme for a two-tier wage plan, which is now being proposed by both Democrats and Republicans. In fact, workers in the South, in a state of North Carolina, which has approximately 2% unionization rates, even in the United States, that's a horror show. Workers at a meatpacking plant, what do you call them here? It's where you process meat. I heard that's not the same word. Whatever. You got my point. It's the largest one. They are in the midst of a unionizing drive, and in response to the raids and deportations or attempted deportations of workers in that plant, both black and Latino workers, by about 1,000 of them, walked out. It's been a non-union plant, walked out to stop the raids and deportations in previous months. Even 200 Walmart workers a few months ago, 2 months ago, walked out for 2 hours in protest of an attempt to slash their shifts and slash their wages, and in fact won something. This is, again, a non-union workplace. Naturally, it's Walmart. Even students this past week studying the history of the sit-in and civil rights movement in the 1960s right outside in suburban Chicago, 250 of them decided to take their lesson and apply it and had a little act of participatory democracy themselves when 250 of them occupied their own high schools, their 14-year-olds, and they were dragged off and every single one of them arrested for demanding that their teachers not be laid off as a result of budget cuts. So this is some of what you have brewing. Again, there's not a consistent organization for it, but nonetheless, some of this stuff is beginning to percolate. Even the Republican-run and owned Chicago Tribune newspaper just the other day has come out calling for abolition of the death penalty. Surely an anachronistic, horrific Dickensian nightmare that still exists in the United States. I should add, right now, well over half of the American states have effectively put an end to the death penalty for now. There is an effective moratorium as a result of the shifting consciousness against it. And I'm proud to say that comrades of ours in the United States have played a not small role in fighting that battle against the death penalty with others in the campaign to end the death penalty. We'll end on this note because I think that there's shoots of hope in the United States, but the lack of organization remains something that hangs over all of this sort of hopefulness. You know, the fact that you can have Hurricane Katrina 19 months ago and yet no mass protests in the United States demanding a federal works program for the people of New Orleans to build their own city and demanding tens of billions of dollars, which is what it would surely cost to rebuild southern Mississippi and Louisiana. The fact that you have an anti-war movement that is fractured with a leadership that is largely quite sectarian and internal. You have, you know, all of these kinds of things, but nonetheless, I think that the elections in November, as much as we in the ISO stand outside and build independently of what we perceive as the two capitalist parties, but the Republicans and the Democrats, we understand the amount of hopefulness that people have. I mean, after all, the fact that a black man in the United States, a country built on slavery, a country in which racism is woven into the very fabric of everything that goes on in the United States, the fact that a black man is perceived to be a legitimate and quite potential winner in the 2008 election is something that is an expression of the hopefulness that people have right now. Really, for the first time in 30 years, there is an open debate about ending poverty in America. The politicians are being forced to have to talk about this because there is such a crisis. There is a discussion for the first time in 20 years in the United States, a real debate about universal health care. Hello, we live in the largest empire in the history of the world, the biggest economy in the world, and nearly 50 million Americans have no access to health care. It's an outrage, and people are sick of it. And really, I think that, you know, these are very painful and economically harsh times in the United States, but at the same time, there is a turn away from the kind of cynicism that people were feeling only months before the elections. I think it's important that people understand that people can't buy the hope about America and Americans that sold to not only you internationally, but to us domestically. Like every other capitalist country, the United States is a land of contradictions. Nobody ever would have predicted the explosions that took place in the 1930s that shaped anything that's decent about American society. The weekend, trade unions, Social Security, all of these kinds of things came out of the massive upheavals of the 1930s, largely led by people with socialist and communist politics. Nobody ever would have predicted that out of the heyday and the go-go 1920s. Nobody ever would have predicted that the massive explosions of the 1960s that shaped American politics in terms of building a black power movement, a women's liberation movement, a gay rights movement, that ended a war in Southeast Asia. Nobody ever would have predicted that to come out of the soulless 1950s. And so I think that just in ending, you know, our struggle like yours is very similar. It's to build a socialist alternative in the midst of these struggles.